we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
It is now clear that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia. This is part of a group of nerve agents known as Novichok. Based on the positive identification of this chemical agent by world-leading experts at the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory at Porton Down, our knowledge that Russia has previously produced this agent and would still be capable of doing so, Russia's record of conducting state-sponsored assassinations, and our assessment that Russia views some defectors as legitimate targets for assassinations, the government has concluded that it is highly likely that Russia was responsible for the act against Sergei and Yulia Skripal.
A cloud no bigger than a man's hand can be the harbinger of great storms ahead. So goes the biblical injunction, and so describes where we are in 2018 with this rampant Russophobic hysteria that has exploded across the UK political and mainstream media landscape over the poisoning of former Russian military intelligence officer and MI6 agent Sergei Skripal, along with his daughter Julia, in the cathedral city of Salisbury, England. The clamour unleashed by Britain's establishment press to apportion blame for the attack to Russia from the moment it occurred has ensured that the ensuing police investigation has been conducted in a pressure cooker of anti-Russia and anti-Putin invective. It has led directly to Prime Minister Theresa May making a statement in the House of Commons during which she claimed that it was, and I quote, highly likely that Russia was responsible. Let me be clear. I am not claiming that Russia did not carry out this attack, an undeniably heinous crime which placed the lives of British citizens at risk. It certainly put the life of police officer Nick Bailey at risk, who attended the incident and was a victim of secondary contamination, but who thankfully, as I speak, is recovering in hospital. So no, I'm not saying that Russia didn't do it. What I am saying and do say is that given the seriousness of this crime and what it portends for relations between London and Moscow, relations that were already in a parlous state, a verdict of highly likely by the nation's Prime Minister is simply not good enough. As I have said elsewhere, Russia is undoubtedly capable of carrying out an attack of this nature. It has the capacity and is undoubtedly ruthless enough. The question is whether it possesses the requisite stupidity. Mr. Skripal, after all, had served 4 years of a 13-year prison sentence in Russia for spying for MI6, having been recruited by Britain's Foreign Intelligence Agency in the mid-1990s. He received an official pardon, by the Russian government in 2010, preparatory to being included in a high-profile spy swap for Russian spies who were then being held in the US. Thereupon, Mr. Skripal lived for 8 years in England. He did so openly under his own name, rather than a concealed identity, suggesting that he did not consider himself to be in danger. And to my knowledge, he was not involved in any activities that were a threat to Russia or its security. So why try to assassinate him, and why now? If it was Russia, i.e. if the Russian state was responsible for this crime, I condemn it unreservedly. But lest anyone make the mistake of believing that British intelligence are the eternal goodies and their Russian counterparts the eternal baddies in the Manichaean world depicted by what is a vocal coterie of British jingoists, unfortunately for them, some of us know better. All intelligence agencies and governments have and do commit heinous crimes. London's colonial and imperial history is littered with them. The point is that governments and their intelligence agencies do not operate on the basis of moral principles. They do so on the basis of what they consider is the national interest in any given period? And when we say national interest here, we're talking about the interests of those in power. This deranged anti-Russia hysteria bears all the hallmarks of the hysteria that was whipped up in Britain and throughout Europe in advance of the First World War in 1914. Witnessing supposed leftists and anti-establishment voices folding like the proverbial deck chair in the face of it, their bovine acquiescence in what is now a shrill chorus of Katargo Russia Est, i.e. Russia must be destroyed, is to witness a mass Pavlovian response to national and state propaganda. People may say, what are you waffling about? No one's talking about going to war with Russia. Well, no one was talking about going to war with Germany and Austria-Hungary in 1914 either, when Archduke Franz Ferdinand of the then extinct and now long forgotten Austro-Hungarian Empire was assassinated by Serb nationalist Gavrilo Princip. I'll wager that hardly a person in Britain could find Serbia anywhere on the map. Ultimatums were issued, demands were made, and threats launched, leading to the same on the other side, pitching Europe into a downward spiral that led inexorably to 4 years of carnage in which 15 million perished. History is a signpost. As of now, I must tell you, it is pointing us in the direction of catastrophe. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Piers Robinson is an author and political commentator. He is also chair in politics, society and political journalism at the University of Sheffield in England. And he joins me now. Piers, welcome to Hard Facts.
Hello.
Now, we've been here before, Piers. You were around. You were very active in the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2003. And one of the most striking things that have been said or written in response to this recent unleashing of Russophobic hysteria, which I mentioned in my introduction, was a tweet by George Galloway, who was very prominent back then. And he writes, and I quote, "The kind of consensual frenzy I watched in the House today, with Corbyn's nuanced position openly derided even on his own side, was chillingly familiar to me. When the Commons is unanimous, it's usually unanimously wrong." Your thoughts, Pierce?
Well, I got a feeling of deja vu at the moment. And as you've just pointed out, the run-up to the Iraq War was a period where we had very bold, confident statements being issued by the British Prime Minister at the time. I think the words he stated was that it was beyond doubt that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. And there was a similar kind of frenzy in the press when those statements were made. Those statements were accepted largely at face value. And as we know, as happened in Iraq, and we had a six-year inquiry into this at the cost of millions. There was no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and it was also, or it has been established over time very clearly, that there was a manipulation of intelligence, which, and the intelligence services were involved in this as well. This became very clear in the Chilcot and the Butler inquiries. And that was fed up to the political establishment, and then the bold, clear statements were made, and they were all completely incorrect. And here we are again, 17 years or so later, and we have a very similar process at work. We have information coming up from port and down, from intelligence services, a prime minister making clearly very strongly directed statements that they believe the Russians are responsible for what has happened in Salisbury. And there is almost no serious questioning going on, and that's extremely alarming.
And people like yourself, who dare ask any questions, are attacked. And this is similar to what, as I say, happened in the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2003. Painted as traitors, painted as being soft on Saddam, painted as being Saddam apologists. Now we're Putin's apologists. It's really chilling. The parallel, isn't it?
People should be extremely alarmed. This is almost what one's reminded of Goebbels at Nuremberg, and this idea of all you have to do in order to mobilize the population is to tell them there's a threat out there, accuse anybody who questions of being a traitor, and you've got control of the population. And that seems to be very much what is happening at the moment, and it's extremely alarming. A straightforward parallel, in the case of Iraq, we were drumming up the claims in order to justify a pre-planned invasion of Iraq. And that was done extremely effectively. and it mobilized the population, it mobilized the press. But that was against a country which had no meaningful defense, okay, against the West and against America and Britain. In this situation, we're talking about Russia. Russia is a nuclear power. Whatever the rights and wrongs of the foreign policies of the West and of Russia, that's the context in which this, I would describe, almost bordering on war fervor is whipping up. It's potentially something which can lead to, at some point down the line, a conflict with another nuclear power. And people should be under no illusion that that is, you know, the worst case scenario here. So this is a time for calm, measured, rational debate and critically serious interrogation from journalists, the public and academics and politicians as to the claims which are being put forward. That never happened in Iraq. The claims were paper thin, and it became clear after in the inquiries that there was no justification for the claims the government was putting forward. And that really needs, that kind of question needs to be occurring now. Otherwise, we run great risks, I think, of escalating the situation with Russia and somewhere further down the line. Sure, you suggested potential for war and so on. That potential is there. I'm minded to think this is more to do with misdirection and ratcheting up sort of pressure on Russia rather than any kind of desire for conflict at this point in time. But
we don't know how Russia is going to respond, though. That's the unknown quantity, you see, because this will only feed anti-British feeling, which is already underway in Russia. This will only feed that. We cannot predict how Russia will respond to this. When we are now threatening them with a 24-hour ultimatum to explain themselves, hauling the Russian ambassador in London in front of the foreign secretary with no evidence being presented in advance, that is an insult, is it not?
Well, yeah, it might incur a response from Russia in the way you describe. I mean, it might also be the case that Russia is not particularly concerned about the UK itself. The UK is simply not prominent or powerful enough in the international system. I think the dovetailing of this, I think Tillerson was making comments yesterday, the dovetailing of this with the US foreign policy agenda, for example, in relation to the Ukraine or in relation to Syria, then if you add those two things together, I think you could be looking at a more serious pressure on Russia to respond in some shape or form, which, as you suggest, could just simply lead to, well, if we weren't already in a Cold War, I think we pretty much are, then we are going to be into that situation. And we have all of the potential of it rolling out into the kind of sort of the nightmare scenario that we had during the Cold War era of an arms race, mutually assured destruction and so on. We really are pushing ourselves into that territory at this point in time, and that's extremely alarming. It should be alarming to anybody with knowledge of history and with knowledge of the state of the international system at the moment. That should be a real warning sign that whatever the challenges there are facing humanity, whatever the challenges there are facing the international system, we're not going down a road which looks like it's going to lead to consensual or diplomatic solutions to problems. It looks like we're leading down a road which is actually going to carry on the kind of very belligerent agenda which the West, led by the America, has had over the last 17 years. And that can get us to conflict, undoubtedly. That's the worst case scenario. I don't think we're there yet, but that's definitely something which people should be very mindful of and thinking about, rather than repeating, as you suggested, or buying into this hysteria that we have at the moment.
Well, you've just given a fantastically eloquent presse of where we are in the current period. I think your point about the consequences of conflict with Russia are absolutely key to this issue. Because Russia, as you say, is not Iraq after 13 years of sanctions in 2003. Neither is it Libya with very weak military forces relative to the West in 2011. Russia is the largest country in Europe. It's the most populous country in Europe with 800,000 men under arms and some of the most advanced weaponry, if not the most advanced weaponry, in the world today. We just had Vladimir Putin, during his address to the Russian Federal Assembly in Moscow, unveiling Russia's new next generation of nuclear missiles, which supersedes anything that the West has in its arsenal, including Washington. You don't have to love Russia to understand that going to war with Russia in 2018 would be a very very bad idea. We're just coming up to the break, Piers. After the break, I'd like to get into Russia's point of view, because we're not really having anyone in the mainstream, or certainly not enough people in the mainstream, giving us the point of view from Moscow about how relations have reached this point. You're listening to Piers Robinson. This is Hard Facts. We'll be back right after this.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Piers Robinson. He is an author and political commentator, and he is the chair in politics, society and political journalism at the University of Sheffield in England. Now, Piers, we're getting one side of the story. We're getting the side of the UK that Russia is this aggressive state, that Russia is intent on reforming the old Soviet bloc. It has aggressive and malign intentions towards its neighbours, Ukraine, the Baltic states, Poland and so forth. I mean, this is nothing more than a fairy tale if you understand the real history of post-communist Russia relations since the early 1990s. NATO's eastward expansion is a real security threat for Russia. We now have thousands of NATO troops deployed right up to Russia's western border, the very same border over which Hitler's Nazi war machine invaded the country in 1941 to sow devastation and carnage on an epic scale. We have the missile defence shield that went operational in Romania in 2016 in the face of Russia's protestations. And we have, as Putin identified, the Bush administration unilaterally withdrawing from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty in 2002. Russia is reacting to what we're doing to them. Would you agree?
Well, you're absolutely right that Russia is being presented as a threat. Okay, and I've heard this chatter, I've heard it within military circles, you hear it amongst the public and so on. Now, the bottom line, and this is something which I've been talking about quite a bit since I sort of read through the whole of the Chilcot report and then wrote about it. But the reality is, if you want to take an objective analysis of the empirical record of the last 17 years, okay, or if you want to look at extended out through to the end of the Cold War, and as you pointed out, NATO's expansion, if you want to identify the states who've been acting in a belligerent and aggressive fashion, is quite clearly the West. Quite clearly, the United States, following 9/11, engaged upon a regime change strategy. And that isn't even in dispute anymore. This was even contained in the Chilcot report. And the Chilcot report has a fascinating communication.
Sorry, just to clarify, sorry, quickly, for our international listeners, and the Chilcot report was the last inquiry into Britain's role in the war in Iraq, and it was as damning as you would could expect to get from an establishment inquiry regarding Britain's role and the role of then Prime Minister Tony Blair in taking us into that war in 2003. Sorry, continue.
That's okay. And that report confirmed what a lot of people on the margins have been saying for some time, that there was a regime change strategy that was put in place. And the communications between Bush and Blair showed that was quite clearly actually the case after 9/11, that there was a plan put in place to remove countries. There was a conversation between George Bush and Tony Blair talking about when to hit Syria, Iran, and Iraq. And what we've seen over the last 17 years is this strategy changing course and so on, but essentially rolling out over a number of years. We see it in Afghanistan, we see it in Iraq, we see it in Libya, and we see it in Syria. And the West, and also now in Yemen, in terms of our support for the Saudi operations there, these are highly destructive, violent conflicts which have been initiated and or fueled by Western governments, primarily the US, and with NATO following in behind. And from the Russian point of view, coming back to your initial point, from the Russian point of view, it's perfectly reasonable for them to be looking at the West and the behavior of the West and to be extremely concerned about the threat that's emerging. It's not just NATO expansion to the east. It's not just whatever has been going on in Ukraine and the Crimea. It's to do with the kind of regime change operations which
US hegemony, isn't it? US hegemony.
That's the bottom line. This is what it is. This is, you're talking about the politics of empire. And what, as the years roll by and as more information comes out, it's becoming more and more clear that the elements within the US, the response to the expected emergence of China, possibly the resurgence of Russia, was to use America's predominant military force in order to exercise influence in the international system as much as it could before its competitors, i.e. China, would block that from happening. And this is what we've been seeing going on. And I mean talking about it in a very sort of abstract academic sense, but we're talking about conflicts, we're talking about war, which has killed countless people. Concerned physicians report from, I think, estimating up to 2009, just looking at Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan, was numbering the dead from the conflict, over a million people. Okay, so this is a large loss of life, and this is very much the result of...
Which is feeding anti-Western sentiment in the Middle East, which directly responsible for the emergence of ISIS and other Salafi jihadi groups.
Yeah, absolutely. And the West is wound up supporting extremist groups in Syria, as has become patently clear. And again, that's a matter of the public record. And all of this is being lost in this kind of focus on Russia and this hysteria over Russia. And this is why I think a lot of this is to do with misdirection. It's directing the populations of the West away from the actions of their own governments, the kind of chaos and carnage which has been caused by those actions, and trying to persuade everybody that really the threat lies out there.
The bogeyman thesis.
When in fact the threat, the real threat in the international system, to a very large extent, has been the West and the actions of the West. And that's just a straightforward, objective reading of the empirical record that we have over the last 17 years. And it's amazing, although perhaps for anyone who studies propaganda, perhaps it's predictable. It's amazing that that's forgotten in this heated, hysterical political atmosphere that we have at the moment. These lessons of Iraq, awareness of what the West has been doing, is simply being swept under the carpet, and we're being told to fear a new enemy. And I mean, we had a British Defence Secretary, didn't we, a few weeks back, talking about how Putin wanted to kill people in Britain.
Secretary Gavin Williamson's speech followed on from his US counterpart James Mattis's inflammatory speech unveiling the Trump administration's new defence strategy, which identified Russia and China as threats, as actual threats to US hegemony. Now, I'd like to get into the ideology of this, Piers. I'm interested in the extent to which people educated at Eton College, Harrow, Fettes College, going on to Oxbridge, dominate the UK political and media class. I've made the point before, and I say it not out of hyperbolic reasons, I really mean it. These institutions, these elite educational institutions, are our madrasas. These are hotbeds, in my view, of extremism and fanaticism, because that's where these ideas of the right to rule, the might is right, the Britain's imperial legacy has been something virtuous and glorious and something that we need to maintain. That's where these ideas are inculcated in succeeding generations of the ruling class. And the alarming convergence between the political class and the mainstream media class in recent years, despite Iraq, is a real problem for Western democracy, for specifically in this case, for democracy in the UK. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, there's always been a big overlap between the mainstream media and the political class and the establishment in the way that you described. That's always been there. It might well be that it's reasonable to argue that that has intensified in recent years. But what you're alluding to there, or perhaps not alluding, making quite clear, this is ideological. And actually, I take it much back further. This is the ideology of the West in many ways, of this notion of liberal outlook that we are the leading sort of leading entity in the international system, that we hold the high ground in terms of morality and action in the international system. And that kind of belief that we are the ones with the white hats and everybody else is the one with the people with the black hats, etc. Idea is very deeply rooted in the Western psyche. Now, none of this is to say that some of the developments in terms of democracy aren't good, okay? Advocate that, etc. But it's this idea that we should be leading the world and that we have moral superiority when, to be quite honest, when you look at the track record of foreign policies and you look at it from a realist point of view, John Mearsheimer, the American realist, is very good on this. He's very, very clear that liberal states like to tell themselves ideologically that they are the force for good in the world, but their actions are really ultimately driven by their own interests. And as you suggested there, in the context of a class system and so on, it tends to reflect class interests. So this is the kind of ideology of the West, that we are the ones who hold the moral high ground. And that's extremely dangerous, because that ultimately has been used to justify and underpin military actions, overt and covert, for many, many decades. And I think this is the ugly reality of the West. And this is one of the reasons why the West has come to lose so much support internationally, is that its claims, or its sort of internal moral norms, which it claims to adhere to, that doesn't adhere to them at all in terms of the way it acts in the international system. And so you see aggressive military actions, covert and overt, throughout most of the Cold War era, in fact. And all the time that is happening, you have Western publics and political classes almost blissfully unaware of the actions which are being carried out in their name. So it's a kind of a false ideology here in many ways.
Manufacturing consent, as Noam Chomsky famously put it, the manufacturing of consent by the mainstream media, shaping public opinion and public attitudes, telling us who our enemy should be at any given period.
Sure. They maintain, that's a Walter Lippmann phrase, of course, which Noam Chomsky uses for his book with Edward Herman. And of course, Walter Lippmann, although he's slightly ambiguous on this, he sort of believed in the need to sort of control the masses, etc., and through propaganda. Although he was ambiguous on that, but yes, but this is manufactured through the mainstream media, and it maintains the ideology. And underneath all of that, or as a result of all of that, terrible crimes are carried out. Talk to anybody in Vietnam, Laos, or Cambodia, who were at the receiving end of American firepower for many, many years. Terrible crimes are carried out because, as Chomsky has pointed out throughout his entire career, for example. And, you know, we're still in exactly that point. This, in 2018, we have the same dynamics, the same processes going on. And really, because the international system now is changing, and because we do in many ways have to accommodate the reality of China, for example, it's absolutely essential that people in the West, and the political class, and journalists, finally, to actually look in the mirror and to reflect upon the actions of the West, and to recognize where we've been at fault, as well as pointing out where other people have been at fault, and then to take that greater awareness into a more progressive, engaged, and diplomatic approach to international politics, which doesn't involve the use of force to the extent that we have been employing it. But this is a time for the West, I think, generally to wake up to the problems within its own systems, the failings in democracy which need to be rectified, but also its behaviour in the international system. And if we don't do that, as you suggested at the start of this radio broadcast, if we don't do that, then there's every chance that we'll end up in a highly conflictual international system, but in an even greater conflict at some point down the road. John Pilger's the Coming War of China documentary is very worrying and disturbing in terms of what his concerns are about the potential for conflict with China at some point. But that's where this is all heading, and people need to keep that in mind and need to look in the mirror, and people need to stop the hysteria and start engaging in rational debate and dialogue. And on this very specific issue to do with the poisoning and so on, is to actually start interrogating the British government as to the claims which are being put forward about Novichok nerve agent, which I don't have time to talk about. But we need robust, aggressive questioning. We do not need everyone following the lead.
Pierce, I'm afraid we've run out of time. Thank you very much for your wonderful insight and analysis of this very, very important topic. I think we're at a stage where the words of the great Martin Luther King are eminently appropriate when he said, "We start dying the day we become silent about things that matter." This, I suggest, is no time for people of consciousness or conscience to be silent. You've been listening to Piers Robinson. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.